The Pacific Group. So y'all help me give a warm welcome to Clancy I.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm going to start off by doing something I never do, but I think you need to hear it. In the early 1960s, there was a guy in the San Fernando Valley named Bill Davidson, who was kind of a fanatic old fool, and he had strong opinions about things, and when they would read the traditions, he would whisper along with it, "Principles before personalities." He didn't believe there should be anonymity, just even in the AA, it should be all anonymous, you know. And you can't come here this late and get seats when I'm talking, kid. Anyway, he would say this and say, "Shut up, Bill. Not going to be shut up. Needs to be said." Then there were two or three young guys who start mocking Bill, and they would say, "Principles before personalities, is that right, Bill?" He'd say, "Shut up, whatever needs to be said, Bill." And then some guy from the Sylvan Cedros group came over there to talk and heard this and thought it was a new spiritual breakthrough. He took it back to the Sylvan Cedros group, and for about 20 years in the middle of the San Fernando Valley, there were four groups that used to chant, "Principles before personalities." And then somehow, I mean, you'd say, "Where are you going?" I would not speak to the Greek chorus. And somehow the cork got out of the bottle. Pretty soon you heard it in South Pasadena. Then you heard it in El Monte. And sadly enough, it's here tonight chanting. I mean, I don't know how it got here, but if you're new, you don't have to chant. You're not... It has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, and just gives the person an illusion that he is participating. But you can chant if you want to. I don't tell you you can't chant or you can chant. I just thought you ought to know why they do it. You're not helping AA. All you're doing is mocking Bill Davidson. And he's been dead since 1971. So. Anyway, all right. I'm glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober, and glad to be in Dallas again. I've been here several times since I got sober, but today, for some reason, I wasn't feeling terribly good physically, and I got thinking about all my days in Dallas, my last days in Dallas, which was a terrible period. I remember I was working at Tracy Locke, and I was drinking very heavily, and I'd had some bad luck. I was drinking a lot. In fact, a couple months before that, one night I was playing the piano in some cheap bar and drunk again, and somebody finally came in, found me, and said, "Your wife's in the hospital. She just had a baby and they can't find you." So I jumped up and went to the hospital. And I'd had a son that died, so I was full of zeal. I said, "Doctor," he said, "she has a RH factor in her blood." And I said, "Well, take my blood. If you have to drain my blood, make her live." And he smelled me and he said, "I think she has better luck with the RH factor." But I remember the day that the boss at Tracy Locke called me in and said, "You know, Clancy, you do good work, but... You're not doing what you almost cost us the Frito account last week by one of your omissions. And I guess the omissions come because you drink too much and your supervisor talked to you about it and you won't listen to him. So I'm going to let you go. I want you to hand back all the material you have of ours. And he said, "If I have anything to say about it, I'm going to see that you never work in advertising again." Which kind of overreaction, I thought. And he said, "And we have notified your wife that we're fired. You notified her yesterday. She has the right to have some peace in her life." And I thought, well, there's no sense going home then. There'd be nothing but trouble there. So I stayed out and drank for a few days and finally came home. And they were all very sad. And I still had a car, however, and I was And it's something I've forgotten till just today. I always say, then I left Dallas, but I didn't. I got a job over here at Southwestern Engraving as a production manager downtown. And I used to come to work in my blue convertible every morning, whizzed down there. It was way down by the river. And I remember the day that two guys came in and said, we're from General Motors Credit. Give us the keys to the car. And took the car, and I tried to, they're going to tune the engine. So then I had no way to get home, and I was a long way from home. I lived over here, just a few blocks from here, on Drexel Drive. And so I began staying late and taking the red pickup truck home at night, and then have to get it back in the morning before anybody got there. That was tough when you're drinking, but I had to do it. And then one night, I didn't quite get home. I was on Lover's Lane. Down Lover's Lane, there used to be a bunch of bars together down there, maybe still is. And I came out at closing time looking for my red truck. It was gone. I couldn't find it. I looked all over for it. Where's my truck? Oh, God. I didn't find out for a couple of days what had happened. The owner of the Southwestern Engraving Company had been driving along Lover's Lane and saw his truck. So he had his wife take his car home, and he took the truck and left me to wander and look for it all night long. And by the middle of the night, I was very sick and drunk, and two guys took me down and put me on the lawn of the hospital. Maybe they'll fix you in the morning. Then in the morning, some people came out there and put me in some sort of a drying-out facility. And I finally got out of there, and I got home, and my wife had left. She left all my clothes on the front porch. All the furniture was gone. She was gone. She had finally listen to those sinister Al-Anons. And I knew I had to get out of town because I was free. I don't know if you remember, I might as well go tell you a little bit about Texas. Sometime before that, I'd been committed to the Big Spring State Hospital, not for drinking, as a successful suicide who'd been brought back to life. You have a treat tonight. You not only have people who lived in Texas, but who died in Texas. And to get out of there, you have to be signed out to somebody. I was there from 1956 to 57. Got a lot of shock treatments, got a lot of things. They really blasted me. But I was signed out finally to my wife, and they told her, in case he ever acts badly or does anything strange, call us. We'll come and get him. And I knew she must have called the vengeful bitch. So I knew I had to get out of town, and the guy, I sat and thought, how did I get in this situation? My life, you know, I remember sitting and thinking that, how did I get in this situation? I grew up in a nice little town up in northern Wisconsin. I was raised in a very strict church. I was confirmed and catechized, and when the war started, I was full of patriotic fervor, although I was only 15, and my parents got divorced. I ran away from home and ran to San Francisco, lied my age, and was in the Merchant Marine. I was in Pearl Harbor before my mother didn't know I was in Duluth, and when I got old enough, I went in the Navy and came back. They had the war, I was in the Naval Hospital up in Northern California, and they passed around some tests. I've always been great on tests because I read a lot. They told me I was in the top 5% of intelligence, the entire Navy. I said, I know. But what that did for me, it got me not have to go back to high school. I'm still a junior, beginning junior in high school. I was able to go to college after the war, the University of Wisconsin. And I doubt if there's anybody here, hardly anybody, alive that still remembers that 1946, what a remarkable thing that was. But millions of guys got out of the service all at once, and most of them went to colleges. They just jammed all, because you got the GI Bill, you got some money, and they took care of you. And you'd sit in freshman English class, and some grizzled old veteran next to some little honey just out of high school last year. Were you in the war? Yeah, do you put out? A lot of them did. I found one that did, and I've been married to her for 65 years. Pardon me. And I went to college. I got to be a pretty big guy in college. I could do some things well, and I won some trophies for university. And that was. Then I came out of college and became a sports writer, which to this day is my favorite job I've ever had. But I married this Catholic girl. She had some cock and bull story about being pregnant. And so we got married, and then after we were married, she really turned up the volume a lot, because I didn't know that, but Catholic girls turned out a lot of children. Boom, boom, boom. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. It's kind of funny, you know, you think about it now, young people today say, well, how would you have so many children? Because you use birth control. And I went to my wife, I remember saying, can we use birth control? No. But I don't know what I'd have done if she'd have said yes, because it's hard to believe in this day and age. But in those days, no, I had been through a war. I'd been through a major university. I heard the word condom once in my life in a Navy training film where it showed this really buxom girl saying, if you go to bed with this girl without a condom, you'll get some terrible disease. At that stage of my life, I wouldn't care what I got if she'd go to bed with me. But what you would find in those days is kind of bad kids who say things like, I got a rubber. And even they would be ashamed to go and buy them. They'd have to hire someone depraved. And they'd go, and even they'd be ashamed. You'd say, hey, give me some cigarettes. And some rubbers. Now look how much progress we've made in the last 60 years. The Rite Aid drugstore over my house in Los Angeles. Kids come in there. I guess they're grown up. They look like kids to me. Say, hey, give me some condoms and some cigarettes. So I had to get a better job, and I went to work. And a guy suggested I go to work in a big corporation as an advertising guy, and I did. I had a flair for writing. I wrote very well. And already my drinking had taken a terrible turn in college. I was drinking a lot. In fact, my senior year, someone had said to me, you know, you're starting to get arrested overnight. Now, no big deals, but they got this new thing downtown called Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe you ought to go to that. Some of the town drunks are going there, and even they're slowing down there. Went to this room with eight fat guys sitting around a table. One guy says, what the hell are you doing here? I thought, that's odd. But I don't know why, because at that time, I was 22 and looked even younger. And there wasn't anybody under 40 in AA at that time in that state. So just like some little 8-year-old kid coming in this morning saying, I think I'm an alcoholic. Oh, do you? I think you have a broken nose. Yeah. But I went to this alcoholic job. And if you're new, we got some new people back there. It doesn't take long to learn about AA. Alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. They come to AA and admit their problem is alcohol. That seems to cheer them up a little bit. Then they return to God, and then they help others. Just a wonderful group. Very much like Ten Commandments, just wonderful. But it doesn't really work in the real world, but it's nice to talk about. And I realized that I wasn't going to, they had nothing for me. Unfortunately, I was cursed with intelligence. And I could see through these 12 steps, just a bunch of hokey things, saying I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. And I later look back and think, that is the greatest curse that people have coming to AA, I think, is accepting those first three steps. I think that's kept more people out of AA than anything I know. Because I'm not really an alcoholic, I'm not crazy, and I'm not going to turn my life over to God because that doesn't work. And I carry that. But I started going to AA then in this city where I was working. In this corporation, they called me in eventually and said, you know, Clancy, you're doing a good job, but we need you on Mondays, too. And when you come in on Tuesday, you smell bad. And I didn't know what to make. I knew I was on those skids, but I thought, Mr. Carlson, I've got an idea. You know, I know my drinking is terrible, but I got drinking overseas in the war, you know, so many horrible things. And they got this new thing downtown called Alcoholics Anonymous. If you'd give me maybe a week, two paid, I'll go down there and get healed and then can start working. He said, okay. Because nobody knew anything about AA, that it's just kind of a mysterious place where people went and got sober. So I went to the meeting in that town, Beloit, Wisconsin. I was working for Fairbanks Morse. And the same old crap, dumb, I drank, I stayed drunk. I don't know if I ever heard this talk, but for years, it seemed to me, every time I went to an AA meeting, some guy would do a version of this one. I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years, night and day. One day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy. Hasta la vista, baby. And I went to AA for a while, but I could see this, they're no help. So I got another job. I had some good samples I'd written. I could always get another job. And I started doing that. I did that for years. All of my kids have been born in a different state where it's going to be different. And where I finally went down and never came back up was Dallas, Texas. I used to go down and bounce up and down and bounce up. And here I went down and it was over. And I remember a friend of mine had said a couple weeks before that, you know anybody wants to drive a car to Los Angeles for me? I'll pay him. I said, no, all right, buddy. But that day I did. I called him up and said, Jim, I know somebody wants to ride your car to Los Angeles. He said, who? I said, me. He said, I thought you were working at Tracy Locke. Ah, they're a bunch of phonies. I quit. And I got in the car and he gave me some money and a gas ticket. I got as far as El Paso the first night, where I used to live. The one time I was on the faculty of the university there. I went to Juarez, where I'm famous. Stood on the bar of the Chinese palace singing my little song. Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua. And all my fans say, cabrón, cabrón. The next day I got up pretty hungover, but I had to keep going, so I got as far as Phoenix. And I didn't know anybody in Phoenix. I thought I'd better hide this car, just like El Paso. So I hid the car, and I hid it well, because I haven't found it yet. All my clothes, all my money, everything I had, all my ID. And that night I was drunk on the street, and I was trying to get a guy to help me. I said, will you help me find my car? He says, no, don't bother me. I said, come on, help me. I got to find my car. Everything I got is in it. He says, don't bother me. I grabbed him by the lapel, bad habit I had. He says, I wish you would have done that, kid. He took out his badge. He's a plainclothesman. Took me over to the Phoenix jail, put me in jail. Oh, God. He said, I'm going to cool you off, boy. I don't know how much cooling off you get in a jail. It's 130 degrees on the third floor. But I slept anyway, and I woke up in the middle of the night and I was sick. Oh, God, I was sick. Oh. I went over, threw up a toilet. Except it wasn't exactly a toilet. It was a guy's bed is what it was. But he wasn't in it. It was all right. It didn't hurt anybody. And then I lay down next to it. I'm sure some of you have done this. After you throw up, just lie down and put your cool cheek on the cool tile. And, oh, God, that feels good. I did that at 3 o'clock this afternoon. I remember that. And this guy came back from wherever he was and found his bed full of puke, and this drunken fool said, you drunken son of a bitch, just kicked at me. I'm sure he didn't mean to do it. He kicked my front teeth out. You think that's funny? Wait till I get to the part where I die from leukemia. I bet you'll like that. I'll tell you, a few years before that, I spent about $10,000 in psychoanalysis because I had a pattern with drinking that bothered me. And it proved I wasn't really an alcoholic, but it still bothered me. Because, you know, they always say alcoholics can't stop drinking. I can stop drinking. I've stopped drinking many, many times for good reasons. My problem has never been I can't stop. My problem is, after I stop, in a day or two or three, somebody seems to sneak into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. Come here. A little restlessness. A little irritability. Come on, knock it off. Getting my daily sermon, what I did the last time I was drunk. Why don't you shut up in there? Little by little, watching whatever technicolor there's in my life, slowly go back to that damn gray. And pretty soon the job is gray and the house is gray and the people are gray and I'm sick of this gray existence. And that's, I've just kept. Gets better later. No, it really doesn't, but he doesn't know. And living in a gray existence is just intolerable. And I've tried everything. I went to the psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and I paid almost $10,000 for his course. And I took pills, and I read his book, and I went to his classes, and it doesn't help. I'll tell you how you overcome that feeling. Oh, Jesus, that's good. But then you want to remember to say, I'll watch it this time. And never once know that you can't watch it. And when that guy kicked my teeth out that morning, that was the first time I ever was glad I'd spent all that money in psychoanalysis. I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, that son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything to make trouble. So I got there the next morning into the streets of Phoenix, very hot. My coat had been torn somehow. My shirt was full of vomit and blood, and my mouth was bleeding. So sick. But I'd learned something in my last year of slipping. And you may want to remember this if you want to become a long-term slipper. When you get to a point where nobody wants you in or nobody wants you around and you look bad and smell bad, there's one place you're always welcome, an AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Jimmy. And I said, where's the AA club? And somebody said, it's over there. I went to walk to the AA club and sat down, kind of smelled bad, looked bad. Some old lady, I could just see her light up. She came on. Are you sick, young man? Yes, I am. I want to get into a 12th step house, but I don't have $20 to get in. She goes, well, here you are. I took that and ran downtown and bought a bus ticket out of there. Got to Los Angeles. I had some terrible time, short time in Los Angeles. I got some money from a guy and then he wouldn't see me anymore. One morning I woke up in a situation that a person of my background and intelligence cannot be in an all-night movie. I don't know if you're familiar with all-night movies on Skid Row, but they run all night. They don't really run all night. They run until 5 in the morning, but they're designed for bums to go in and sleep for 25 cents. They smell bad, and about 5 o'clock they come into the hose and say, everybody out! So hose it down. But it gets you off the street. I remember coming out of there at 6, 5 in the morning, raining outside, cold. I didn't know anybody, didn't know anywhere to go. I was sick. I thought, how could this be happening to me? My mouth started bleeding again. Some guy said, you want to sell a pint of blood? I said, Jesus, yeah. So we walked up about 8 blocks to a blood bank, and we stood in line, got in line. The guy took a blood drop of blood from me. He said, you don't have enough iron in your blood to sell a pint of blood, kid. I said, Jesus, I'm so sick. Help me. Help me. I'm so sick. He's down here about 4 blocks or something called the Midnight Mission. That's designed for bums like you. Go down there and get some breakfast. I said, okay. So I walked down there in the rain. And got in there, and the guy said, gosh, you just missed it. We just got done serving. I said, I got to have something. Please, I'm so sick. He said, come back at lunch. We'll give you lunch. I grabbed him by the lapel. Bad habit. I got to have some help now. Two guys stepped over and took my hands off and threw me out the door and said, don't come back, you son of a bitch. I tried to tell them, I'm not a son of a bitch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. ads that I helped write, the LC number ads for the Borden Company. We're running that very week in Life and Time, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's really hard to explain those things in midair. I stood outside that mission and I just didn't know what I'd do. You know, it's a funny thing. I think about this a lot of times when I hear stories in AA. No matter how sad they get or how tragic or how hopeless, you know, it's just a matter of a few more minutes, they'll say. But then I found this wonderful program. You know the ending already. AA would be a lot more listenable if every so often you hear a guy say, and then just couldn't make it, shit. You'd really listen closely then. But if I stood in front of that mission in the rain, if some old guy came up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. He could have said, you're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, way back there, they called you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes now. You're a bum. Your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you even, because your stepfather's so tired of watching you play on her emotions, so she'll go down to her tiny little bank account, take out a few more dollars and send it to her little boy. Hope that'll help him. He'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. And he might have said, you've been in and out of AA now for 10 years, almost 10 years. Every time you're in a jam, you go to AA meetings and you sit there and smirk and think about these idiots, their little steps and their little slogans. Oh, God, they're just idiots. And wait for the heat to get off so you can leave. He said, now you're dying, he might have said. Why don't you go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic? See what happens. And if someone had said that to me, I'd have to give them the answer I was given. They were honest. You don't understand. It isn't the way it looks. I have a lot of problems. I have a lot of emotional problems. But I'm not an alcoholic. By that time, I wish I were an alcoholic. I wish I were dumb enough to be able to go in meetings and sit down and feel better instead of seeing what nonsense they have. But nobody came up that morning. And I remember saying to some guy, where's an AA club around here? He said, well, there's nothing downtown here. Closest one's Wilshire and Fairfax. I said, where the hell's that? He said, well, go up this hill to Hill Street, cut over to Wilshire, walk west till you come to Fairfax. Ah. And I had no idea it would be 7.5 miles. God, what a terrible long walk when you're raining. My mouth started bleeding. And then I almost didn't go in. I came to the door, and there was a guy standing inside the door saying, welcome home, son. Ha, 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 ha. Oh, but I went in and stayed out of sight that day because I don't know if I just want to get out of the rain. If you hang around the A clubs, every so often some do-gooder wants to come over and talk to you and read you out of the book. Let me read this part of the book to you, or let me tell you about my story. I don't want to hear your crap. So I stayed out of sight till nightfall, and then they had a meeting, and everybody in the club had to go to the meeting, which was a mixed blessing. At least they served cake, and I had about 4 pounds of cake because I could chew that. Then went to the meeting and they talked about gratitude and almost puked it up again and came out. Stood out in the hall and everybody went home except the manager and I. And it's still raining. And I knew he was going to throw me out soon. I thought I got to beat him to the punch. So I tried to put on my newcomer look. I thought, I'm a newcomer. And I have no place to stay. It's raining and cold out. Could you folks in AA help me? I want sobriety on an all-time basis. He says, you're in luck. A guy named Joe Quinn left a 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. Doesn't run, but you can sleep it as dry. You mean to tell me AA in Los Angeles, the answer to homelessness is sleeping in an abandoned car? He said, good deal, huh? Yeah, that's really good deal. And I woke up the next morning cold and sick and covered with blood and went inside. They're setting up another meeting. So I had 4 pounds of cake and went into the meeting and they talked to me. It was a spiritual meeting. Whenever I go to a spiritual meeting, I just get up and leave. When I hear the word God, I'm up and gone. Because the only thing God ever did for me was kill my little boy because I was a sinner. Screw him. And that day I hung around the club. And that night there's another meeting. The manager of the club said, you know, you can only come in here on the weekends without being a member. During the week you have to be a member. But you're such a mess, I'm sure you haven't got any money to be a member. So I'll tell you about my new kid, I'm gonna let you come in. Three rules for you. Can't ask anyone for money, which you've already done. None of your smart, sarcastic remarks, which you've already done. And you have to go to a meeting every night. Oh, Jesus. I wish this stopped raining. I'd be out of here like a rocket. But I did. I said, all right. Now, had no idea that would be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be. You know, third tradition read so well tonight by the young lady mentioned that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I had no desire to stop drinking. Stopping drinking to me is lethal. The one time I ever stopped, as I mentioned earlier, I went through a spell in the mid-50s where I got just enough alcohol, I'd be out counseling police officers, pointing out their errors. Jesus, stupid. And I'd get thrown in jail overnight. Not very well. I could come out of there in the morning, go home, take a shower, and go to work. It didn't bother me. But I came out one morning, and one of my neighbors was there. I said, what are you doing here? I got that cop's badge number. I'm going to screw him around like he's never unscrewed. Don't you worry. He said, I don't know about that. He said, well, you're a drunk, your little son died, and we couldn't find you. And I had three little girls and one little boy, and that just about killed me. Oh, God. Oh. And being drunk in jail, my little son died. Whatever vestige of decency left in me just shocked. So we took him up to Wisconsin and buried him in the foot of his grandmother's grave on the mother's side. And I put my hand in his casket. I said, John Emmisland, this will never happen again, I promise you. I'm so sorry. And I came back and I quit drinking. Boom! I didn't go to AA because AA makes you want to start drinking. I quit drinking. And for the first time in a long time, I'd come home at night after work and have dinner with everybody. And we'd talk and laugh, and every time we had a meal, we said a prayer for baby John. That's very nice. And then it helped the kids with their homework sometimes, and sometimes we'd go for a ride. Just wonderful. Had 2 or 3 weeks of just, our family had never been like that. And then one night, wouldn't you know it, somebody snuck into my bedroom, put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day, I still wanted to do these things, but a little tense. And the days went by, I got more and more tense. And, Mary, take your sisters and go to your room, for Christ's sake! I'm sorry, honey, we'll play tomorrow. I don't mean to holler at you. Just tense like that. I needed one drink so bad, but I promised my dead little son I wouldn't drink. What do you do? They just on and on and on. One day my wife got up, took the kids to Mass, and I pulled the car in the garage and hooked up a hose and exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. I just didn't know what to do. And a neighbor next door was watching out of the window. I guess he had a cup of coffee in the breakfast nook. And he saw me go in there, and I didn't come out, and he heard the motor running. So he ambled over and found me dead in the car, and he pulled me out, and they beat at my chest and rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me. And when they had my health back, they determined to go and look at me emotionally and determined I was seriously mentally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum in Big Spring, Texas, for an indefinite period. Now, that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks, for good reasons. Why would I stop for no reason? Why would I stop this time so I could be cold and wet and sick and watch my mouth bleed? I'll tell you what happened to me. In those meetings I went to that next week, I saw a guy in the meetings that I had seen in the movies. I thought, a movie actor? What does that tell you? Very wealthy. I bet he'd like to have a new friend. I kind of moved in on him. He didn't want a new friend. But it kept raining. And, oh, God, sleeping in that damn car, cold and sick every night, and eating cake. And by Friday, I could realize, I'm going to die. I got to do something. My last vestige of self-pride, I have to sell that out. I'll pretend to ask this guy to be my sponsor. I said, Bob, I really admire your program. Would you be my sponsor? He said, sure, Kenman, I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I thought, that simpleton, I'll turn him inside out. Well, shortly thereafter, I discovered he wasn't a movie star at all. He'd been in 3 movies in cameo roles, and I'd seen him in 2 of them. I've been in many more movies lately than he ever was, but I didn't know that. And they said he wasn't a good actor, but he was a good actor because he acted nicely at meetings. And that took a lot of acting for him because he turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Just terrible. Do this. Why am I taking this crap from this idiot? Because he was my only meal ticket out of there. But he tried to help me. He'd come down sometimes and pick me up at the club and take me out where he's speaking. Or sometimes he'd come down and buy me a soft meal or something. And almost and preach to me. And he took me out to Brentwood, which at that time was the biggest meeting in town. And he was speaking. I sat there, and before the meeting started, 5 minutes into the meeting, some young man got up and said, I'd like to make an announcement, please. He said, I came here 11 months ago, and I was having a lot of problems in my life. And you folks pointed out to me that I was drinking too much. I never knew that, but I can see it now, and I went back, and I stopped drinking. And my job is going well, my family's going well. I haven't been back to your meetings. I've had no desire to drink. It's just been, that's what I need to have. Thank you. And everybody's like, oh, wonderful, another success story. And after the meeting, I noticed old Bob pounce on him. Said, you got no business being an AA. You're wasting our time here. Get the hell out of here. Jesus, got an overreaction. And on the way home, I said, Bob, why'd you jump on that kid? He's sober. He's because he's got an alcohol problem. I said, Bob, I hate to tell you this, but AA is designed for people with an alcohol problem. No, they're not. We have no need for an alcohol problem, and people with an alcohol problem don't need us. Oh? What do they need, Bob? They need to quit drinking, clean up their act, and when they're offered a drink, say no, thank you. I said, that doesn't work. I've been trying that for 10 years. That doesn't work. He said, apparently you don't have an alcohol problem. You must have what I have and all the rest of these people around here have. I said, what would that be, Bob? He said, something that sounds like alcohol and fools a lot of people. Kills him. Something called alcoholism. I thought, Jesus, Bob, don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than you'd believe. Shut up, he said. And he gave me about a 3-hour harangue, most of which I was able to blot out before I went insane. But in that harangue, he saved my life, and I never even knew it. He pointed out that difference again. And I never knew it. He said, alcohol problems are over caused by drinking a lot of alcohol. And when you come to a problem about it, you quit. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism, stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that. They always say getting sober is the answer. He said, nah, getting sober and doing nothing about it is worse than drinking. Huh. I said, well, why do all these alcoholics drink so much? They always talk about how much they drink. They drank. Why do they drink so much, for Christ's sake? If it's hurting them so bad. He said, they're not drinking because it's hurting them so bad, kid. You don't seem to know much for all those years you've been around, you say. He had a cup of coffee in his hand. He said, if this were Johnny Walker, and I took a big drink, the first reaction I would get would be almost instantly alter my perception of reality. Just a little bit softer. A little more pleasant. And you have a few more drinks and it gets better. You know, I've searched for years to find a way to define what alcohol does. And I stumbled onto 2 sentences that I wrote a couple weeks ago. And you can steal them if you want it because you probably think they're silly. But what makes an alcoholic? Alcohol has the power to make me into something I am not. And alcohol has the power to keep me from being what I am. And that's exactly the way I'd use it. It makes me something that eyes don't seem to be able to be when I'm sober. And it keeps me from being that nervous, frightened goof. And drink and drink. I said, Jesus, Bob. But I stop at bars after work and I have a martini or two of the guys, and they all go home. Are they all pussy whipped? Is that what's wrong with them? I said, no. He said, alcohol doesn't do for them, but it's doing for you. What makes you an alcoholic? Alcohol has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. That is the only requirement to be an alcoholic. It has to do something special for you it doesn't do for other people. I said, huh. But there was a girl at our meeting the other night, and she spoke, and she said she'd been sober and got drunk again, and then got sober again. Why would she get drunk again? So that's the other part of the disease, kid. And he had a theory that I thought was ridiculous. But I heard a tape of it 30 years later. I thought, by God, that's exactly right. He said, it's not easy for people to grow up in the world, and you grow up at different rates of speed, and have to learn a lot of painful lessons. Some people never even get to be, you never even know what the goal is. The goal is to become emotionally mature. You don't even know what that is. Some people get to be in their 60s and they're not emotionally mature. Some people are emotionally mature at 18. But it's a great thing. If you can become emotionally mature, you lead a pretty good life. You seem to be able to hold a job as long as you want to. You instinctively get along with your fellow employees. You get along with your mate. You know where to give in and where not to. You're a good parent. Get along with the neighbors. Go on square vacations and enjoy them. It's pretty good. He said, but it almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because you get through emotional maturity by working through painful situations. And we don't work through them. We have found out we have a painful situation. I can drink it away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Carlson, take your job and shove it up your nose. And they all work because I've done them all. He says they all work. But every time they work, they leave an invisible, cold little ball in your psyche somewhere. And you get a whole bunch of them. You don't even know they're there. The only time they ever come alive is when you stop drinking. And that activates them. Bzzz. And that's just a matter of time. Whether it be at home, or job, or work, or street. Till somebody hurts your feelings. Or discriminates against you. Or treats you badly, and little by little you can see it happening. And I think about it a lot. Sometimes you can lie awake at night thinking about these bastards, what they do to me. You get to a point where literally you must drink to preserve your sanity. Isn't that ironic? Drinking is going to make us insane, but sometimes you have to drink to preserve your sanity. He said, that's the curse of the alcoholic. Can't continue drinking and can't stay sober. I said, huh, that's the story of my life for the last 10 years, Bob. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh, because he was profane, unlike me. He said, you're an alcoholic, kid. I said, alcoholic? But how can I be an alcoholic? My number one problem is really my emotions more than my drinking. He says, kid, an alcoholic is not a person whose problem is alcohol. An alcoholic is a person whose answer is alcohol. And if your answer is alcohol, it'll be a problem as long as you live. And he told me that in December of 1958, a long time ago. And I thought, what if I am an alcoholic? What if I really am an alcoholic? Wouldn't that be odd? Maybe I'm not crazy. Maybe these intermittent crazy spells are part of a pattern. But I thought I might be an alcoholic. I started believing it then. And I never had another drink or a pill. The hardest battle I ever had to fight was to believe I was an alcoholic. And I'm going to quickly go over the second and third step because they saved my life. I remember my sponsor said, well, it's time to go through the steps now. Now that you're an alcoholic, I said, Bob, I cannot return to God. I cannot return to God. I can't do that. No matter what you say, I can't. He said, well, you're lucky. Nothing in A says you got to return to God. Look over there on the wall. It says you come to believe in something. We never ask you to go back to any old superstitious belief. You got to come to believe in something here. Can't you believe in a loving God? And I said, no. He said, can you believe in AA? I felt like it better than I used to, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? Of course you are, Bob. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that because I believed he was trying to help me. Whenever you're in AA, you've got to remember, they ask you to find a power in the second step. It could be any power that you can accept. Nothing, not what they've got after 10 years, but you can find it. But the big problem in the second step is, because you got to remember, there must be a power here. These people didn't all stay sober so they could come and fool you tonight, you know. Probably not. But the power is going to what? Restore me to sanity. What the hell is sanity? You can read 10 medical textbooks, get 10 different definitions of sanity. Oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. When the human brain is under sufficient and intense complex pressure, it can find no relief. In order to maintain its neural integrity, it will alter its perception of reality. That is called psychosis. Now, if you does it all, it's easy to spot and they put you away. But it usually has to be just something to be triggered. You read in the paper, well, I've been exploring this guy for 10 years. And God, one night he just came home, took a rifle, killed his kids, killed his wife, killed himself. Why would he do that? Something triggered his psychosis, I guess. But here's the interesting thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that odd? You'd think we'd be the number one students for that. They don't. Unless you're psychotic when you come in here, you're probably not going to become psychotic. And I didn't understand that at all. This guy finally told it to me in Washington, D.C., a very brilliant man who I respected. He said, kid, it's easy. He said, alcoholics, if they feel bad enough, long enough, drink alcohol. If they drink alcohol, it alters their perception of reality. You and I have the power to temporarily induce psychosis. Happy days. Except next tomorrow, we'll be back to reality and the psychotic will not. So that's kind of nice. So I guess what the second step means is I have to try to believe there's some power here somewhere that will make it unnecessary for me to drink alcohol. Easy to take that step. And the last step is to turn your will and life over to the care of God. I can't do that. God is a vengeful, nasty Norwegian Lutheran beast. I remember I had Bob as my higher power, and I remember he said, time to take your inventory. And I said, Bob, I've taken my inventory with a professional psychiatrist. Why don't I ever take it with an out-of-work actor? What are you going to do, say, cut? Everything pissed him off, seemed like. And one day I got fired as a dishwasher at the Gaiety Delicatessen, and it wasn't my fault. But it seemed to me the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. So I thought they were getting them in other restaurants to humiliate me because I was an Anglo. So I just piled up a bunch of them, turned out I miscounted. I went back to the club and I got fired as a dishwasher. Sober 6 months, fired as a dishwasher. People I got sober with are got jobs and girlfriends and families and homes, and I'm going to have to go back to sleep in that abandoned car again for a while. I sit in the club late at night, and I remember saying to Sullivan, I said, Sully, I might as well be drunk or commit suicide. My life ain't working. And he said something, you know, Clancy, you're probably right. He said, there's about 8 people in this club who like you, and they try to defend you. There's about 150 who don't like you and wish you would go away. He said, now, so if you drink or commit suicide, you're going to make those 8 people who like you feel very bad, and those 150 bastards who hate you very happy. Is that what you want? No! No! I was so desperate, I went in, I'm going to take my inventory! And I wrote an inventory, I put down, oh God, if you ever write an inventory, do it while you're feeling bad. When you're feeling good, it's, well, I guess I wasn't as perfect sometimes. But when you're really bad, if you're, I'm a dirty son of a bitch. Try to avoid the teardrops falling on the paper. And I shoved it under the backseat of my car, and Bob heard about it and came down a couple of days. Time to take your 5th step. Bob, I'm not ready to take my 5th step, really. I got to assimilate what I wrote. He said, oh, shut up. Get in the car. So he drove to Oxnard, gave me a flashlight along 40 miles along the ocean. I read this to him. And it read even worse than I remember it. Because I don't even have the decency to be a big-time bad guy. Just a sneak and a liar and a cheat and a betrayer of people. And just... I said, well, I'm done now, Bob. He said, yeah, you've done now? Yeah. He never said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. And as a result of that, little by little, I was able to hold a job. My 2nd year, I held a job for 4 months before I got fired. Record. After my 2nd birthday, somebody put in some clout for me in a medical corporation to begin a beginning writer in their advertising department. And that would be great, I thought. So I went to work there, and they said, you know, remember the first couple of days, the client said, we didn't expect you to have this answer, but we're trying to cover this description of this procedure. We can't seem to get it together. You want to give it a shot? And I said, sure. Now, God, I'd written a whole treatise on that 8 years before. I just, boom, boom, boom. They said, oh, that's great, Clancy. That's exactly what we're looking for. And I knew I was on the way up. And then a couple of days later, some guy in the worked with me said, I heard him say, he doesn't even have front teeth. I tried to disguise it, but my sponsor had taken me to a thrift store and got me some clothes. They didn't quite fit, but they were nice. I held my lip like that. But every time I got started, see, that's what happens. Somebody starts screwing me around. Now, isn't that just the way it is now? He's going to let up. He won't let up on me. Everybody's going to be laughing at me. I might as well just punch him in the face now and quit my job. But I thought, if I do that, I'll have to explain it to that damn Bob. So I called up that damn Bob. I said, Bob, there's a guy ridiculing me here at the work. He said, what's he saying about you, kid? He says, I don't have any front teeth. Do you have any front teeth? No, but that's not the point. He's being vicious. Ask him why he said it. Are you crazy? I know why he said it. He's trying to hurt me. Ask him why he said it. So I got this guy aside. I said, I understand you think it's funny. I don't have any front teeth, huh? So, oh, no. It's just the opposite. I was telling somebody, that thing you wrote is really good, and you got ill-fitting clothes on, and you got no front teeth. Something bad must have happened to you back there somewhere, and you're making a comeback. But you're doing great, and my hat's off to you. And I said, oh. Well, we went through 2 or 3 more of those things. By the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that big corporation. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I came into Hollywood, brought us in Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio. Became the #1 hard rock station in the world. We brought the Beatles out to California. We were all slicker than anything. 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. But I was 5 years sober with the same wife, and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas. Leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. But it was a little boy, and I sure cried when he was born. I was so glad to have another chance. And somebody gave me a Catholic book on the rhythm system. That ended all that stuff. I got so I could say, not tonight, dear, I've got a headache. Now they're all grown up. Three of my daughters are turned 22 last year in AA, and the others aren't alcoholics, I guess. Only one of my children, one of my daughters has turned out bad. I hate to talk about that because it's kind of depressing, but my oldest daughter, Mary, has become a judge. I so wanted a defense attorney, but no. She came home for Christmas a few years ago and said, Daddy, remember your little girls, you'd get in your moods and shout at us, make us go to our room? I said, yeah, of course, darling, but you know why. She said, of course I do, Daddy. But when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I'm not going through New Mexico on the way home. I'm flying right over that baby. But isn't that nice? But I'll tell you, the point of all this is this. When I was somewhere in that first 15 years, I came to finally understand what AA is about. I mean, I know what it is, and I did a lot of speaking, but at a different level. I suddenly realized, you know what AA is? AA is designed to very slowly do what alcohol did fast, to change my perception of reality, to enable me to live comfortably in the world with some degree of self-worth, to live quietly, at peace. And it's a great thing to learn that, because, you know, when you're new, you think, how long do I have to stay dry? Am I going to get drier and drier? I've been sober 53 years. I may burst into flame in front of your eyes. And that's what you got to remember. The things we do here, I owe whatever comfort I have because my sponsor took me through the steps, and I did them. I knew all about them when I came here. I thought I knew all about them. I just had never struck me. I had never done them. When I did them, they worked. Get a sponsor that you can go to bed and think, I hope that old son of a bitch dies. Get up in the morning, be glad to see him. And it makes you feel good. And sometimes these feelings of goodness, they don't come all at once. After you write an inventory, you feel good. And then after you make amends, feel good. And one day you feel good and aren't even aware of it. And one day in some hideous fit of feeling good, without being aware of it, I found myself resigning my job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 38 years, as of February 1st, running the Midnight Mission on Skid Row, the place that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why did you give up your great career to run that damn mission? And there's no good answer for that one. Well, for such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. But Monday morning, I'll do something you won't do, I'm sure. I'll get up. I live out in a big house by the ocean. Today, everybody played in the yard all day long, where all these guys used to play. And get in my car and go down through Beverly Hills downtown in this ravaged area called Skid Row. And I'll go take my walk around the building in the morning, see who died over the weekend, who smashed their head to the sidewalk in convulsions, or who overdosed that damn crack or all that. I'll go in the building, and then my staff and I will try to find ways to get these poor bastards off of there. It's very difficult to get people off Skid Row. Not because they're so pleasant there, but it requires a mindset to be there. And that mindset is, I can't stand pressure. So it's a long time. But we get a few off there. We get them back in the world. We send them off to AA meetings, and they get better. And then I'll go home and have dinner with my wife and my troubled grandson who's living with us, and go to a meeting and sit in the back and judge the speaker. You know, I'm kind of glad to be here. I was here last night, and I was asked to read chapter 5 at the group I went to. And Wednesday, my home group, I've been asked to read the long form of the traditions, but in Dallas, I'm a speaker. But the thing you want to remember is the young man back there who's new, all of you remember, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a mysterious place. It's really quite simple. It means what it says. The steps mean what you need not send away for interpretations of the steps. They means what they say. And Alcoholics Anonymous is exactly the same tonight at the quarterly meeting of the Chicago group as it was June 10th, 1935 in Akron, Ohio. It always boils down to one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different at least enough so that he may take action he does not yet believe in. And that's the first ember of sobriety. And you kind of blow on it. And you watch AA life change. Every change in my life has come about because of Alcoholics Anonymous. A number of years ago, when my sponsor died, I got a new sponsor. I told him, I can't. God hates me. And he said, you're not important enough for God to hate. When I thought about that, that's probably true. I prayed that night for the first time, and I have over the years come to believe in a loving God that my perceptions turned into an evil monster. And so tonight, Dallas, thinking about all my experiences here today and thinking how my life was over when I left Dallas. There was no way to get any better than that. I had that record of the nut house waiting for me and all that stuff. It's nice to be able to stand up here and say, because of the steps of AA, I can stand here tonight and say, God bless you. Thank you.